As you've heard before, some fish species are not having an easy time surviving. Several populations in the region are already on the endangered species list, and things do not look good for cold water fish on a planet of warming water. A couple of years ago, we talked about the California reports on fish in hot water. One of the authors visits again today to talk about an experiment looking into whether a more abundant food supply might offset the effects of warming water. That's Robert Lusardi, who's a research ecologist and adjunct faculty at the University of California, Davis, and is the California trout cold water fish scientist. Rob, welcome back to the Exchange.
Jeff, thanks for having me again. I really appreciate it.
Sure. When we talk about cold water fish, are we generally talking salmonids?
No, not necessarily. I mean, we refer to salmonids as cold water fish, of course, but there are several different species. You can talk about sculpin all the way to lamprey that are cold water fishes as well. But my general research really revolves around salmonids, yeah.
Okay. So now we had a chat last August with Lisa Crozier about the climate threats to salmon and steelhead. There are some distinct challenges there, aren't there?
Yeah. So we found, the last time we talked, we had released the State of the Salmonids report, which was pretty dire. I mean, we found essentially that in 45 years, we predicted the extirpation of up to 45% of native salmonids in California, so that's trout and salmon, and up to 75% in the next 100 years. And the big threat there was climate change, because it's really all-encompassing. Water temperature is the big one, but there are a whole list of effects that really can affect cold water fish there. That's right.
So what prompted the angle of research you took with the water temperature and food?
Yeah, so we found that, we had been studying the Shasta River, which is a lot of people in the region know is a tributary to the Klamath River, extremely productive aquatic ecosystem. It really benefits from what we say is naturally occurring nutrients that comes out of these spring sources at the headwaters. And we're primarily talking about nitrogen and phosphate, and they basically act like fertilizer or something for your garden, right? So it comes out of the springs. We get prolific plant growth in these systems that tends to correspond with prolific growth of aquatic insects, which are food resources for salmon. And then we even see really neat growth rates in these fish that occupy this system as well. And so we thought that historically, kind of what has happened in California and really throughout the Pacific Northwest and even further, is the focus for salmonids, the focus on restoration has really looked at physical habitat attributes. So it's really looked at things like putting large wood in streams, and it's looked at temperature, and it's looked at substrate additions like gravel into a stream to benefit salmon, and it's looked at water chemistry and dissolved oxygen. And these are all very important. But the big thing we're missing is what about food? And there's some good reason for that, in the sense that a lot of streams are oligotrophic, and all that means is that they can be kind of unproductive. But these spring-fed systems, like the Shasta River, like the Fall River, Hack Creek, the Rising River in Northern California, these spring-fed systems are super productive and have a ton of food in them. And so we felt like it was the right time to look at this system, to look at how fish grow in these systems, and what the balance is of that physical habitat versus that food.
It's interesting. So the earlier experiments basically made sure that the fish had good homes, but didn't necessarily think about stocking them with food or at least assisting that process.
That's right. Or maybe not even looking at the food that's associated with those habitats, right? And we know that things like if you have side channel habitat, if you have floodplain habitat associated with the river, these habitats tend to actually have more food than you would expect in kind of the main stem of a stream, right? And so really starting to look at that, too, is kind of where our research is going right now.
So have people tended to focus on the places where the water is moving fairly swiftly and is fairly cold? I mean, all the basic rock and wood features you were talking about?
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of the literature that's out there in the restoration is really focused on that. And again, there's also good reason for that, in the sense that spring-fed systems are unique, right? And there are not a ton of them. We actually have a fair amount in Northern California, and that's due to the volcanic terrains, a lot to do with the Cascades and plate tectonics and subduction and whatnot, right? So, the important part is that I think moving forward, these spring-fed systems from a conservation perspective will be, and just to bring it back to the State of Salmonids report, will be really important habitats for the future for these fish.
Rob Lusardi, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, research ecologist, adjunct faculty at the University of California, Davis, and is the cold water fish scientist for California trout. We're talking about his experiments in the Shasta River Basin, answering the question, or trying to, can salmon eat their way out of climate change? You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you set up a fairly complicated plan here, it sounds like. You actually raised fish?
Yeah, that's right. So it was we worked with our partners at CDFW at Iron Gate Hatchery. We used hatchery fish, hatchery coho, juvenile coho, so very small, about 55 to 70 millimeters or so. And we built enclosures within the river. So we had five sites over a space of about 10 kilometers. The most upstream site was very close to the spring, so very cold water and lots of nitrate. We built five cages there, and then we moved downstream to four other locations. So overall, I think we built 25 enclosures. These enclosures measured, you know, they're about 10 feet long and about 5 feet wide, and lots of rebar and T-posts going into the stream bed, and then using seine netting to keep those fish in the enclosures, and using sandbags to actually close off those enclosures underwater, right, against the substrate of the stream. It was no small task, I assure you. I mean, we moved a lot of sand, I think 1,000 pounds to fill those sandbags, hundreds and hundreds of meters of seine netting, 100 T-posts. I mean, we had a large crew working with us. It took us about a week and a half to set that up, but it was well worth it, I think.
Yeah, the pictures are interesting. I'll share those on our website later today, but they look like upside-down tents or something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's the beauty of it. They were open to the atmosphere, so they could allow, you know, adult insects, terrestrial insects to come into the environment. But they really, the idea here was to make sure that we knew the environmental conditions the fish were experiencing. And so they were really located in very specific areas, and we didn't want to lose them. We lost a few, I think. It's in the paper. I think we recovered about 75% of the fish, which was pretty good. We expected actually to lose quite a bit more than that, just because crazy things happen, as you probably know, in the field.
Oh, yeah. What is the usual range of temperature tolerance in coho?
Yeah. So that was the interesting part about the study is, based on, you know, my advisor's work and dear colleague Peter Moyle of the University of California, Davis, and his work from 2002, Inland Fishes of California, he was also a co-author in the State of the Salmonids report. We generally think of coho, I'm going to have to speak in Celsius here, Jeff, because that's usually what I do when I'm talking okay. fish, but we usually talk about 12 to 13 degrees Celsius and colder, or maybe a degree warmer, something around there. That's about 50 degrees or so Fahrenheit, I would say. And so that's really been kind of the focus of temperatures for cold water fish like coho. Coho are very dependent on cold water, probably the most sensitive to salmonids to cold water. And that's kind of what we expected. So when we raise these fish, we grew these juvenile fish very close to springs where there was very cold water, where it was at 13 degrees Celsius water. We expect that's where we would see growth optimized in the experiment. That's where we felt like we would see this big growth of fish.
But over the time of the experiment, how long was the period?
It was 63 days. So it ran from about early August till about mid-September.
All right. So there's a chance for the water to get a little warmer in that time, I would think, as you get to the end of the summer stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that was one of the beauties kind of the experiment, too, that we want to look at is that time period, that July to September, is really historically a very dangerous part of the year for cold water fish, particularly during drought. This was actually right before the drought. But we wanted to look at that, too, because we anticipated that there could be warm water temperatures over some of these sites.
So what kind of temperatures did the water get to?
Yeah, so it really depended on where you were, right, over this 10-kilometer stretch where we built these enclosures. But what we found was that despite kind of the literature suggesting, and what I've always read as a graduate student and then as a research ecologist at UC Davis, is that we would really see this growth pop at about 12 to 13 degrees Celsius. And it turned out that the fish optimized growth, so they grew really well at mean temperatures of about 16 degrees Celsius, but importantly, maximum temperatures of about 21 degrees Celsius. And 21 degrees Celsius for a cold water fish is very warm. It's about 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And so we were really surprised by this. I mean, of all kind of the science that I've done out there, we pulled the fish out of these enclosures, and it was just that kind of aha moment. It was a great moment for myself and the folks that I work with, because we couldn't believe what we were seeing, that we were seeing this prolific growth at very warm waters in the study system.
So we're talking, instead of being able to, you know, looking for 50 degrees, I mean, at 70 degrees, they were still doing okay? Did they show any signs of stress, or were they actually thriving?
So we didn't see any types of stress that we picked up kind of in the field study. There's been research out there. Folks like to look at cortisol, which is an indicator of stress. We are not physiologists. We are more field ecologists. There's been work done out there by Foote, who works for the federal government, and he's looked at stress in these fish at warmer water temperatures, specifically to Klamath and specifically, I believe, to using iron gate fish, and has found little response in stress markers at slightly warmer water temperatures in some of these fish. But we don't truly know kind of if they went through stress. The growth I would suspect that they probably did at points in time when you get up to 20, 21 degrees Celsius. But their growth suggests that despite what's going on there, they grew extremely well at these warmer water temperatures. And growth is really important for these juvenile fish, because if you're bigger as a juvenile coho, if you can leave the system larger, right, you can swim faster. We have something called gape limitation. Maybe predators can't feed on you because you're larger. You have larger lipid reserves, fat reserves. So if you get to the ocean and there's not enough food, you can kind of withstand a longer period. So growth, the size you are when you leave a system, is really important. And we saw that fish grew really well at about 20 degrees, 21 degrees Celsius is the maximum temperature.
Did you say gape limitation, as in they're bigger than a mouthful?
Exactly, that's right, right? If you're bigger, you have a chance of not only swimming away quickly from a fish, but also if you're bigger, it might be harder for a smaller predator to feed on you.
All right, so just take me back to the 68 to 70 degree pool here, the Fahrenheit I'm talking about. What was there that made those fish grow bigger?
Yeah, so we had a hunch, only because we had studied this system for a long time, for about 10 years, that... and we knew it was very productive. And I think context is really important here. The results of this study should not be construed to look at, these oligotrophic runoff streams. These are very specific habitats that have a lot of food. So when I talk about a lot of food in aquatic habitat, I am talking about spring-fed systems. I'm talking about floodplains. I'm talking about seasonal lagoons, estuaries. These locations have a lot of food, and that's where this work is really really relevant. What we found was that we had extremely high densities of food in the Shasta River during the experiment, and really we see these densities throughout the year in the Shasta River, right? So a typical stream in the North State, a typical salmon stream, we might see 5,000 to 6,000 aquatic insects per meter squared. Okay, that's a rough extrapolation of what we do with our food web data. We say, what is the density of food? So that would be a typical kind of less productive aquatic ecosystem. In the Shasta River, we were seeing aquatic insect densities ranging between 40,000 up to 80,000 aquatic insects per meter squared, which is just insane, right? So if you look at the bottom of the stream, you just see aquatic insects everywhere. And so what we hypothesized, what these fish could actually compensate, right? So if they're experiencing slightly warmer water temperatures, as they were in the Shasta River, that their metabolism would speed up. If you're in a unproductive aquatic ecosystem in that situation, you need to get out, you need to find colder water quickly, or you are going to experience high stress, maybe disease, and eventually death, right? In the Shasta, they showed us that they could actually compensate for these slight increases in water temperature. So as water warmed up, they could actually eat more food and compensate for those increases in temperature, if that makes sense.
It does. But Rob Lusardi, then, can this be extrapolated to other places? It seems like this research comes with a bunch of cautionary notes to not assume the same thing is going to happen anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. And so I mentioned that earlier, and just to reiterate, context is really important here. So places like spring-fed systems, places like the Fall River, Hat Creek, Rising River, Shasta River, headwaters of the Klamath River, which will be very important, I think, moving forward here, the Sprague, the Williamson, places like that, they have these volcanic, they occur in these volcanic terrains. They're very productive because they have these naturally occurring nutrients that come out of these spring systems, right? So these are places where we would expect high food densities and the possibility of these fish to do quite well under slightly warming water temperatures due to climate change, let's say. The same goes for these seasonal lagoons. We obviously talk about a lot on the coast and estuaries and floodplain habitats, which typically have a lot of food too. But it should not be compared to something like the main stem Scott River, which is not as productive as the Shasta River, right? So food, I think, is very important in that system, and restoration can focus on habitats that improve food quality and quantity for fish, but you're not going to have the same food densities as you would on somewhere like the Shasta. And to the same extent, you wouldn't have the same growth rates of fish in somewhere like the Scott as you would the Shasta, and that's something actually we're looking at right now.
I noticed it's been 2.5 years since we talked to you about that second fish and hot water report for California. And given some recent news about the rate of climate change, are you concerned that stream temperatures will get even hotter than projected?
The projections are, you know, they're all over the place. They're not totally all over the place, but, you know, 2 degrees to 6 degrees Celsius is generally what we think. So, we'll see some variability in that depending, you know, if you're, you know, north aspect versus south aspect or where you're located in California, if it's the Sierra, the Cascades, further north. But the fact of the matter is that the science is pretty clear on it, that there are and there will continue to be strong changes associated with the environment for these cold water fish. So not only stream temperatures increasing across the board, as we expect, but also changes in the flow they experience, the flow regime they experience. So earlier, places like the Scott River, of course, earlier snowmelt runoff and longer periods during the summer that could be stressful for fish. So we were really, myself and my colleagues on this paper, really interested in looking at these habitats that could provide this resilience, if you will, under climate change for cold water fish. And in fact, if you remember, Jeff, we pointed out some of these systems in the State of the Salmonids report. But this is really the first study to lock it down and show that these really productive aquatic ecosystems will be important moving forward. And I think that's really true for the Shasta River. It's different from the other systems in the Klamath Basin, and it will be critical moving forward for cold water fish.
Critical and to protect areas like that.
That's right, exactly, and restore, yes.
All right. So the report was laughingly called, at least by the press office at UC Davis, can salmon eat their way out of climate change? The answer is, in some circumstances, perhaps. Rob Lusardi,
I think you nailed it, yeah.
Yeah, Rob Lusardi, research ecologist and adjunct faculty at UC Davis and the California Trout cold water fish scientist. Thanks for joining us again on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure, Jeff. Good to hear from you.
All right, take care.